Terry. We have one more storyteller. This is awesome. So this gentleman has been around since the beginning of the show. I think he's actually like on our first or second episode. A former member of the Nerdalogs. He is back working with us for a show we're putting up at C2E2 next week called Attend the Tale of Danny Tanner, a Full House musical, which imagines Danny Tanner as a person who goes out and murders a drunk driver once a year to avenge his dead wife, which is probably canon. That's probably true. It's going up at 4:45 at C2E2 on the Cards Against Humanity stage. So if you leave Tom Hanks Day early, you can come, but you should definitely go to Tom Hanks Day. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Please welcome our Danny Tanner and our director, Mr. Andrew Bentley.
Hello, I'm Andrew Bentley. Robinson Crusoe, perhaps history's most well-known castaway in the centuries before Tom Hanks washed ashore in our cinemas and slapped his bloody handprint on the volleyball of our collective minds, is the star of an eponymous tale popularly considered to be the first English novel. As the most widely read and distributed work of its time, it occupies a position of unique influence in the development of Western society, as an evangelist of what Max Weber, the German sociologist, would term almost 200 years later, the Protestant work ethic. James Joyce considered Crusoe to be the quintessential symbol of the British Empire, one that generations of red-coated soldiers and mariners carried with them as they forged a dominion that would, at its height, encompass one full quarter of all the people in the world, binding and molding them with an unsolicited paternalism that would have done old Robinson proud. After all, when Crusoe first encounters the indigenous man he will helpfully name Friday, the native lies prostrate and places Robinson's foot atop his head to convey his willing and eternal servitude. The novel, and its inseparable doctrine, trickle down through the decades to permeate huge swaths of Western social, ethical, and economic theory. The prosperity gospel, the sin of idleness, and other dangerous myths that now underpin the cruel form of predatory capitalism, which defines and bedevils our American identity, come to us, while not originally, nonetheless in substantial part through the pages of Robinson Crusoe, and are not met with significant refutation in popular literature until Mark Twain. Huckleberry Finn devotes much of its page count to mocking the Protestant work ethic and the preordained hierarchy of intertwined wealth, race, and morality which define it, and its unprecedented influence in doing so placed the work in serious competition for the title of greatest American novel. This duality is one which I was particularly interested in 8 years ago when I first moved to Chicago, and everything I've said up until now is a mercifully briefer and more sober distillation of the wild, grandstanding diatribe to which I was subjecting two strangers at a house party one warm September before Eric Siegel swung low like a sweet chariot and pulled me away to get high. A risky gamble, equally likely to render me completely silent or to evoke a sort of room-clearing conversational dubstep, but which either way would allow my two unfortunate victims to escape. One time or another, we've all been that guy at the party. For the couple subjected to my bizarre literary screed, that was no doubt a strange and alienating evening. For me, it was just another blurry, quixotic jab at leveraging my BA in sociology against some sort of vague dividend, as if, were I sufficiently convincing, one of them might be moved to offer me a job in the field of drunken stridency, perhaps something in talk radio. It only seems fair to talk about the worst I've ever made a party for someone else, which was either the one Halloween in college where I destroyed a party at JMU because I accidentally chucked a jack-o'-lantern at a police car then hid in the bathroom for an hour, or the night I just talked about, before I tell you about the worst party I've ever been to, which was 3 months later in Brooklyn. From the start, it was a mistake. Four of us took an $80 cab from Astoria to Bushwick because, by pure chance, we were all visiting on the birthday of mutual acquaintance named Michelle. None of us knew Michelle that well. I knew her through some old elementary school friends whom, 6 years after the party, she would defraud to the tune of $5,000 before fleeing across the country. We certainly didn't know any of her New York friends, with whom, we discovered, she cohabitated in an old repurposed public tenement, the front walk of which was split by a 4-foot ravine cunningly bridged by the door to their house. The door to the house had been replaced by a large, equal-sized piece of plywood. A functionalist mystery that implied either a rational response to a baffling sequence of events, or a Dadaist contempt for traditional aesthetics meant to ferret out straight away who the squares and interlopers were. Spoilers, they were us. The first person we met was Michelle's boyfriend, who trailed after her into the yard when she ran out to greet us. When I made the mistake of asking what exactly had happened here vis-a-vis the door, he sneered at me, laughed, responded with a non sequitur, cool shoes, and turned back into the house slowly enough that we could all get a good look at his rolling eyes. He wore that sneer the rest of the night, no matter the conversation, drifting from room to room, looking very much like Martin Shkreli at a free clinic. He managed to maintain it while he was making out with Michelle in the kitchen, and even 10 minutes after that, when he physically threw her to the floor to steal her bottle of whiskey. Everyone laughed the whole time, like it was a big inside joke. They carried on with their conversations while he carried the bottle wordlessly out of the room, and while we helped Michelle to her feet. Perhaps it was an inside joke, one that our shoes were too cool for us to get. The entire kitchen had a horrifying theme of aggressive sexuality. Early on, three of us were having a conversation with a very nice young woman. There was no flirting. If anything, we were grateful for a shelter from the general air of hostility. Nonetheless, when he spied what was happening, her boyfriend approached wordlessly, picked her up around the waist, and carried her away, mid-sentence. A third, entirely separate guy suddenly began demonstrating wrestling moves on a girlfriend half his size. Over and over, he picked her up and hurled her around the kitchen, slamming her into the linoleum while she squirmed and giggled. So uniform was the pageant of domestic violence, so remarkably unremarked that we began to feel altogether gaslit, as if by not bringing our own lady flails to bandy about the room, we had committed an unspeakable breach of guestly courtesy. We fled the kitchen, fools that we were, and became separated. I ended up in a disused bathroom, creeping towards the door while an enormous man with literal acid scars on his face described to me in great detail the pornography he was planning on filming the next day. With who? I asked. With her, he said, and pointed behind me, where I discovered a tiny apple-cheeked blonde so silent I had completely failed to notice her. I excused myself under the pretense of looking for the real bathroom and discovered my friend Brandon literally fleeing a diminutive shutterbug who was trundling after him, snapping pictures, explaining in a calm and uninterrupted monologue the intricate workings of his camera. I could go on, but I don't think I could ever quite convey the nature of the evening without help from David Lynch. It was like I died in the middle of my Huck Finn speech 3 months earlier and my soul had been dispatched in karmic retribution to some Stygian plane wholly peopled by my ilk. The final straw was when the, quote, DJ, who had not, in fact, jockeyed a single disc in the 2 hours we were there, announced he was pouring shots for everyone. When we stepped up to get one, he took one look at us and saw whatever same alien aura had surrounded us the whole evening, marking us as the enemy. He shook his head and closed the bottle. We left. We didn't really know where we were or where we were going, but the party's immune system had thoroughly rejected us. Bushwick was having none of us. We said goodbye to Michelle and happy birthday, and she told us to stay. We told her we had to go. Yeah, said her boyfriend, who had appeared in the doorway behind us. I think that's probably for the best. Then he pulled his pants down and peed in the empty whiskey bottle. As we left the house in Brooklyn that night, in one of the most densely populated cities in the world, we noticed that there were no other lights anywhere on the street. The whole world seemed abandoned, and we were completely alone as we stood in some stunned silence waiting for a taxi. Finally, one arrived, and once we were inside, the spell was broken. Finally, we could find the words to articulate what had just transpired. For most of us, our 20s are a relentless series of voyages into the distant, dragon-strewn peripheries of our personal atlases. As a vitally awkward individual, I have many times found myself shipwrecked on the insidious reefs of strange waters, clinging to whatever jetsam is at hand and hoping it will carry me to safety. But after that night, no other bad party could ever quite touch me. I'd seen the simple truth. When life tosses you up on unknown shores, sometimes you're Crusoe, and sometimes you're Friday. But more often than not, we're all just Tom Hanks. We're a humble systems engineer named Chuck Noland, and all we can do is hold tight to Wilson and wait for that ship.